If you're thinking about opening up a restaurant in the UAE, I hope you know that involves a lot of challenges, costs, and a lot of things that you need to know. I'm joined today by specialist Gabriel Mather. She's the founder and CEO of Restaurant Secrets. It's a restaurant consultancy company. She's been for 25 years in the UAE. She knows all of the details of what needs to be done from a restaurant perspective. Hi, Gabriel. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Ayman. Thank you for having me.
You write a lot about the costs of opening a hole in the wall versus a full service restaurant and dark kitchens and so on. And you talk about costs going up to $500,000. I want to dive into this further because before tech and startups, those in middle class, so those are professionals who've saved some money on the side, they always come to you saying, hey man, I have some money, I want to put it in a restaurant or a pub. That's usually what they do, and they have no idea about the industry. They come in as a silent partner, and then within a year or two, it does well, and then it dies off. And now with tech, they do the same. They have a bit of money, they put it with a founder, even if they don't know a lot about tech, and then they lose on that as well. Is this still the case today? Do people still feel about that? I have some money, let me just throw it into a restaurant?
Yeah, unfortunately, Ayman, you really hit the nail on the head. That's something that hasn't changed over the years. People think it's an easy business. I think maybe because it's related to food and we all eat, we all know how to cook something. It's very familiar. The product is familiar. So we don't understand that once you take that food element into a commercial aspect, there are other things that come into picture, which are business related. So yes, we get a lot of that, but the awareness is growing, I think mainly because of the multiple closures we see. We hear about, restaurants closing down every year, which is making people wary. And then the smart ones will always reach out to a consultant to be able to get some feasibility studies before they launch a restaurant. And those are the kind of people that knock our doors.
So the feasibility usually has the details, right? Licenses, permissions, costs of running it, costs of marketing, communication, fittings, choice of locations, long-term commitments to rent. So it includes a bunch of all of that, but in a spreadsheet that has a nice big number at the end that says, watch it, you're going to hit that huge number. Is that what the feasibility study entails?
Yeah, pretty much. I think it's the why to the what. It's the making mistakes on paper kind of stage.
The why to the what? Tell me more about that.
The why to the what. So I always say, we need to always ask not the what kind of restaurant am I going to make, but why do we need another restaurant? I think we need to start with that question to see the need in the market. I think an entrepreneur, a skilled entrepreneur will learn over time that when you find the secret to what people need, when your focus is on what the market wants and you zero in on that need and you find a way to fulfill it, that's when you have a real successful plan. And for us, the feasibility starts with the why. Why are we opening a restaurant? Before we get to numbers, I don't want to build numbers on the wrong concept, the wrong dream. You could be building excellent numbers. They could be realistic numbers. They could be numbers that allow someone to know what their investment should be, what their returns are on paper. But if the concept, if the product is not right, then there is no point in putting it on ground. So for me, for us as a company, Restaurant Secrets, our tried and tested method is to do a bit of a feasibility, market research first, to see what's trending, what's oversaturated, what are people asking for, what are the target markets, where are they saturated right now, what kind of product is needed in the market, price points, and then we build the financials over it. We first build a great concept, a great product, a great brand on paper, and then we build the rest of the details of it.
But if a restaurant owner is coming to you asking about their concept or feedback on their concept, or they're not sure and they need help on that, isn't that a first weakness? Because if I apply from a tech side, so I'm more familiar with tech businesses and tech startups, it's like a founder coming to me saying, hey man, I want to start an app or a tech company. It might want to do delivery of clothing or ironing or whatever. And what do you think I should do? So that for me is a red flag saying, look, that founder cannot lead this.
Ayman, most of the people that come to us are entrepreneurs with certain amount of funds looking for a business and eyeing the restaurant business, because it is lucrative. You know, a lot of people know that despite the failures and closures, it is a lucrative. If you're going to do well, you're going to do really well. The profit margins are good. So we don't get those who tell us what to do. They don't come in and say, I want to open a burger place, I want to open a pizza place and just do it for us. It's more of, we have a dream. The dream is to open a restaurant. This is the amount of money I've got in my hand. What do you suggest? Where do I start? What should the model be? If they allow us that, 90% of them do allow us that, that's when we can really build. If you've seen from the 300 projects that you'll see on our website, the ones that are turnkey are the ones where we've had an input on the why, which is what restaurant should we do. So should we do a dark kitchen? Should we do a full-fledged cafe? So as a consultant, I really want to get involved at that stage because I really want to be part of their success story, not a story of another, you know, adding on another restaurant on the streets just for the sake of adding one on. So people, when they come to us, don't necessarily come to us with the whole idea in mind. They just have a very raw idea. Most of it is based on, I want to have a restaurant. It is a dream of mine, but I'm open to what kind of restaurant and where I should have it.
How much of that is ego? You know, me being happy to have a physical place that I can invite friends over and they can see and I can give them a free meal and, you know, they pat me on the back and I say, oh, there, you know, I have this guy who visited me or this girl who visited me. Just, you know, how much of that is ego?
How do you know that, by the way? I must ask you, because that is such a true thing, what you've just said. There's a kind of a legacy, you know, a piece of me that people want to see. Part of themselves in their business, in the food business. They love the hospitality aspect of it, hosting friends and being part of this is my place. Yes, it's a very big part. It's a glamour business. People love that. But the sad part is when people take that ego to the next level. I've actually seen restaurants that are not making money, but they're just being pumped into, just being kept, you know, alive for a certain amount of time just for the personal ego or pride of seeing an extension of themselves on ground, yes.
And now they can easily say, oh, we were doing so well, but then COVID came, of course, you know, and then, you know, it's a very polite way for them to shut that down. Yeah. A lot of what I do is I look for problems to fix. And for me, when I look at a restaurant, it's an operational business. It's a very operational business. And I'm very surprised when I see restaurants where the owner shows up in the beginning, first few months and so on. And then, you know, they're not there for a while. And then you get to see how things, you know, go down from there and so on. And I feel it's heavily operational. Can you tell me more about what part of it you can be operational, yeah, heavily operational? What part does the founder need to be involved in after the initial easy part of I'm choosing a logo or a name or a location, but really when the actual, you know, food supply, the actual production, the actual preparation, an issue with the waiter, an issue with the food. So, you know, tell me more about that and how much a founder can step away from the business.
F&B has this glamour to it, has this romance to it, and that is what we see. We see the music, where we feel the music, the food, the atmosphere of dining out, and that is what the consumer sees. But behind the scenes, there's an army of people working. It's very operational. It's very process-driven. It's almost like a military or a factory line kind of a system at the back. The ones who get that combination, that on the front, you don't show that. On the front, you have the romance of the F&B. You have the beautiful service, the food, the music, the online experience. But the back has to be as solid. It's literally, you know, briefings every day. It's literally keeping an eye on your numbers, running your business with numbers, not just with your heart and your emotions. That's the combination. Now, I like what you said a minute back. You said you like helping, serving people. The first thing that I did 20 years back when we launched this company was the website was very different. And the line I had there was, if you have a dream to open a restaurant, I would like to be part of that. I'd like to help you do it right. And that is where my entrepreneurial spirit came out with. I wanted to help people understand not just the good stuff, but the tough part, you know, the difficult, having the difficult conversations with clients. Now, it's not rocket science running a restaurant, but it is a lot of processes. It's a lot of systems. It's taking that passion that you've got, not compromising on passion and quality, but sort of converting it into an SOP, a standard operating procedure, you know, delegating right, And you don't need to be in your business, but you need to be on top of your business. So while it needs your presence, if an owner is walking every single day on the floors, is trying to cook the food, is in the kitchen, is everywhere, it's not going to work either. They have to be the right place, which is on top of the business, in a leadership role, making strategic decisions, putting a lot of systems in place. The back of house, for example, the kitchen has a lot of recipes, has a lot of waste control. We could go on for hours into each one. And I think if you Google this, you'll get a lot of these details on how a typical restaurant has different paperwork, checklists, and formula to work it out. Bottom line, in this part of the world, what I see is the missing gap I see is where people are in a hurry for that restaurant to hype, you know, go within the first 3 months, go right up. Everyone's walking through the doors and they think that's the job done. Now it's just going to, you know, scale or continue going up. That's where the risk is. You know, what goes up has to come down and stabilize. And those are the areas where we personally, when we do turnkey projects, we actually build those SOPs that I was mentioning. We build those systems and we do their pre-opening. We recruit their teams. We train their teams. And we keep the client involved at every time. It's almost like a classroom experience for them where they receive a lot of mentoring, a lot of, you know, details. We share a lot of input with them to allow them, help them to continue with the journey on their own. And then we also offer services after, you know, ongoing audits to make sure they've got those details right. You're absolutely right.
Let's talk more about the SOPs. Because I advise clients on who are building like a tech team, a marketing team, and an app and technology. We help them build that business process internally. And I know how challenging this is. Tell me more about the food equivalent, which I'm not very familiar with. Because the first experience I got from this is, because I originally come from Lebanon. A lot of the restaurants are part of a typical small country where you have a small restaurant with 5-6 tables. The owners usually, it's either family owned or the chef, him or herself, are there. They're very involved, they're very hands-on. When I used to visit the UAE before living here, you know, typical young here, I'd go out late at night and then after 3 a.m. when the clubs closed, I used to go back and eat at these eateries. I used to go to one of the Lebanese ones and I was surprised to find many people, not just, you know, a few staff, many people, they're non-Lebanese, they're preparing food and the food is good. And then I start to think of, you know what, wait, economies of scale, this has to be different. How are they able to get this done well and so on? And with time and experience, I understood what the SOPs are for food and so on. So tell me more about how they're able to do this via their central kitchens, you know, the ingredients and the training that you mentioned.
Okay, let's take an example then. Let's take an example of the best part of a restaurant, the most basic one, which is your product, a menu item. You know, when you have a restaurant that serves one kind of cuisine, I'll take an example of one of our own projects. In 2014, we launched Doner and Gyros. The aim of that, the vision of those entrepreneurs was a scalable concept where they would put four of those units on ground in year one and then start franchising from the first year onwards. So our task was clear. We make a focused product. So we came up with 10 product lines. We build signature recipes of it. And we start with buying the right product, the right cost, and then we convert those products and the cost into a recipe that then gets converted into templates that gets converted into you have another guest on the show, I see.
Hi. We can say hi.
Don't want to say hi to him. It's, we're going to have another kind of conversation if that happens. So I was saying that if you look at just those products, the only way that the client can take that those 10 focused products and then duplicate them in four places at the same time and then go on for 40 branches in the next 4 or 5 years would be if that first product was so well developed, that recipe was so simple, clear, and structured, almost like a factory line document, that it could be given, handed over to anybody. It would not need just a head chef. It could be delegated to any junior. If the chef is off, if the owner is not in the restaurant, you're still getting the same product, tasting the same way, with the same consistency, the packaging, the size. That's one SOP. That's just one SOP, that one sandwich that comes out. you know, how much is the meat inside it? How much lettuce goes in it?
What's how do we make sure it's enforced? Because I see all the time where they start off in a bit and then it's a busy day or the bosses are not there or so on. So how is the, is there like refresher sessions are being done? Is there a compliance officer that walks through? And so how are those enforced? Because they tend to, you know, they tend to be very well done, but then, you know, if they're not followed, they're not followed.
Yeah, human error is the most natural thing, and it exists. And keeping that in mind that there will be human error, I think step one is to make sure that you reduce those elements of human error by providing the trainings, by providing the upfront SOPs and documents for this staff to follow and to produce. If it goes, sometimes you have items that are not in the kitchen. That's a complete no in our industry, you know. Items that, let's say someone's ordered a chicken sandwich and you've run out of chicken. There's an SOP in place to make sure you don't run out of chicken or you don't run out of lettuce. So there is a big element of human error, like in any other business, in ours too. But again, these are done through first initially setting your standards and then having regular trainings. The larger units, the more my client is going towards a central kitchen, is going towards a franchise and expandable, sustainable, scalable concept, the more I'm going to insist on having a quality controlled kitchen. That means someone, his job is just to go and test products. You know, someone's job is just to look at the waste control, to audit your suppliers. Are we getting the same products in every time, or has the supplier shifted? Because if the supplier shifts the cheese, or the egg quality, everything.
Tomatoes or whatever, everything shifts, absolutely. Is there enough money, though, in the business for them to have so many people, so many processes, you have the different layers and so on? Because you did mention in the beginning that it's a lucrative business, but my understanding of this is there's restaurant food, there's restaurant plus alcohol, which improves the margins significantly. So is there room to make money if there's no alcohol served in that restaurant?
Okay, so let's go one by one, right? Is there affordability to have the structure of quality control, waste control? Yes, it's a whole army of people. But then that's for a certain kind of business model, which is the scalable, like the Donut and Gyros I mentioned, or the Zatar Rosates or the McDonald's. These are large-scale units, and they are run like that. They have a corporate structure, and the numbers work out because it's scalable, right? The good thing now is that the current market or the kind of restaurants people are wanting to see are the homegrown, standalone, where there's a bit of an organic feel. You don't really care if the food that comes on your table each time looks like a fast food sandwich or has this typical, you know, structure of packaging. There's a bit of room of personality, you know, in these restaurants. So let's say you have a look at a homegrown restaurant where your expectation of the Eggs Benedict is that it should have the right quality and the taste, but it can be a little bit, you know, not as structured as a McDonald's burger. So there's a bit of a difference there because even the target market is looking at it in a different angle. You like the fact that maybe there's a little bit more parsley on it, or you know what I'm saying? A little bit of shift here or there is acceptable. The more the creative, the product, the more you go towards those Michelins and those celebrity chefs where there is a step where there's personality in the food and things go. So it's affordable if you have a one unit and you have a great chef on board and a great manager on board and you still have a structure on board, you can still manage with a good focused menu. The problem is where people want everything on the menu. That's when the control gets out. If you've got a few signature dishes, and if you've got a good team on board that produces those signature dishes 99% of the time, close to what they were in the first time, people are happy with that. People like that. You know, the bread it's a rustic bread, for example. It doesn't have to be always the same consistency. It can be a little bit having its own personality. We're not talking about McDonald's burgers here.
And is there money without selling alcohol?
That's a trick question. Is there money without selling alcohol? You see, in this market, we live in a country where coffee is the big thing. Tea, mocktails are a big thing. Alcohol businesses have their own numbers. They have their own feasibility. They have their own target markets. A lot of the people who go to alcoholic licensed restaurants don't even drink most of the time. The profits in alcohol are very different compared to the profits in coffee and tea. So per se, you can make a lot more profits and have less licensing fees and less costs over overheads if you are a non-alcoholic, non-licensed business. Once you get into the licensed business, your numbers are completely different and they're nothing like the ones I've published in the last couple of months. Those are related to homegrown cafes, fast food restaurants, dark kitchens. There's profitability in alcohol, but it has to be very wisely entered into. It has to be the right location. It has to be the right buying power. It has to be, there's a lot of elements that go into the licensed business. Very different from the non-licensed one.
Help me understand the restaurant owner's relationship with delivery. Even before COVID, always for them, it was always the place. And then I want to run it in the beginning, let it succeed. And I know, and then as soon as it dies down a little bit in the beginning, the hype is there. It's like, you know what, let me start delivery orders. And then, so I would send them this day one, start. I mean, you're paying your rents, you're paying your people, you're paying everything. It's just, you know, it's a layer. It's just a sales channel for you. For them, it's always the place. And then the delivery part. COVID came in. I had some discussion with restaurant owners who were referred by friends. And I get these discussions saying, Ayman, it's like 2 months into lockdown. Like, Ayman, do you think I should do? And I was like, what are you talking about? You've been closed for 2 months. You've paid rent for 2 months. You paid salary for 2 months. Why are you even asking me? I'm not a restaurant specialist, but, you know, it's just basic math. You're burning cash. So, but for them, it's always just, you know, fine, my competitor is doing it, fine. It's just an additional line item on my revenue. So tell me more about the psychology behind this before we go into your recommendations on how to make the switch.
We are a delivery country. From the time I've come to this country until now, it's just getting easier. It's becoming more the norm to order in. We don't have the time, but our lifestyle does not permit us cooking the kind of food that we'd like to eat. So I think the error lies in when your feasibility study, when your commercials are not allocated to the right profit channels. Again, based on the product, not every food can travel. So not every restaurant that launches itself has to have a delivery model built into its business plan. But there are a lot of restaurants that thrive on deliveries. And when we do business plans, for example, we always have an allocation of profit channels, the typical ones being dine-in, delivery, takeaway, and the percentages differ based on what the cuisine is and what area they're in. Post-COVID, yes, delivery became the staple of a lot of our restaurant owners, and a lot of them turned towards it. But I agree with you, Ayman. Delivery is not something to look as if I don't do well, I do this. That's not the right way to start it. So when we start something, we have the aggregators on board, we start the digital online marketing, we bring in the partners on board, and we gently launch the delivery from day one, because there's packaging to consider, there's operations to consider, and we have to allocate that right at the start and slowly build it up. It's an important channel, as I say, for most of the products, not for every kind of restaurant, but for the category that we serve as consultants that we specialize in, delivery has always been 20 to 40% of the sales of our clients. Some of them are based only on delivery, like Doner and Gyros is 80% off delivery. So again, we need to discern that, you know, what channel deserves what kind of percentage, and then you allocate your CapEx and your operating costs towards those channels.
You talked about takeaways. Can we talk more about that? Because in the US, it's big. Here in the UAE, I don't see enough. I don't see a lot of it. Recently, I saw some of the food aggregators. They're saying now we offer, you know, takeaway where you come, you can order it via the app and then you go and pick it up and so on. Help me understand the value of takeaway, because for me, if it can come to my house, why would I want to go get it? Even if I'm saving 2-3 dirhams, I don't see it. So help me understand takeaway. Why has it not picked up here, and why in other countries it's a primary thing?
I think maybe because it's not a walking culture. It's not a culture where you just step out and you walk down, pick up your bread, and you walk down, pick up your eggs, and you walk down, you know, pick up your meals. We are a culture that drives, the weather permitting. When we do step out in the good weather, we want to just hang out, have coffees, walk around, and have a lifestyle kind of an outdoor thing. I think that contributes a lot to why people don't just walk in and have the patience to wait and pick up something. The ease of delivery. Anybody will deliver anything in this country. You know that, right? One phone call and you can get your Panadol. You can get water.
Phone call, an app. I don't want to talk to anybody. Let me use my app and just, you know, why are you calling me? I have the location. You have the location. Just, yes. So for sure.
So spa at home, you know, everything can be done. Your dog can be walked. Someone can come pick him up, take him for a walk, bring him back. So we're growing more and more into a city that likes to conserve its time on eating out, on lifestyle pursuits. So I think maybe that could be the reason why I take out. But what we do see in take out is where you need to be prepared for someone to take home something they've liked. So it's very usual for large families to order things, they like something and they take it back home. Sometimes you have merchandise, like in La Serre, we have a lot of merchandise and, you know, ready items, baked items to go. So a lot of people do come and walk into La Serre in downtown. It's a walking culture in that part. And they pick up bread in the morning, they pick up breakfast and they enjoy the walk or the scooter or, you know, the bicycle they've come on or the dog they're walking and they pass by. I think the more of those kind of places that have a community space where people can walk in with their pet or while shopping, they'll find a lot of takeaways going on.
There's an episode of Seinfeld where he was helping Babu, the restaurant owner. I don't know if you saw that.
Yes.
So do you get a lot of those where, let's say, you have a customer and you say, oh, my aunt or my cousin, she said we should do this and I think we should do that. And you look at her, you're like, so do you get a lot of that in your line of work?
I get so much of that I wrote an article on it. It was one of my first articles that I ever wrote. People still read it and refer back when they come to the consultation that, you know, that article you wrote about, you know, my mom cooks great food, someone opened a restaurant. That's my story. That's why. So, yeah, we get that. I think that's something we started the conversation with too, right? That people think it's an easy business. Just because you're a good cook, you should become a restaurant owner. Unfortunately, we get a lot of that. And we have to stop them from cooking themselves and tell them, let's get the professionals to do it and let's become business owners, not just overnight chefs. Yes.
Tell me more about the content you've been writing that you've referenced. So what's your process and what opportunities has this created, right? So I came across you from an article you read and here we are today, right? So has your writing and whatever interests you that created more opportunities for you? Do you have a process that you follow saying every month I want to do this, every 2 weeks I want to do that? So walk me through your content generation process and the benefits of that.
I think, Eamon, I've just grown into that. I've been a reader all my life. I'm a learner until the day I go. I think the best part of life is learning and expressing and communicating yourself. I've been writing forever. So everything, every concept that we churn out, that we build in RSI, I've written those stories. And because I'm a reader, I have a lot of stories that I've built up over the years. I'm a concept creator. So when you create concepts, you need to be able to express them. My language is writing. I write and then I visualize them through mood boards and then I bring them to life through the commercials. Writing these articles recently has just been an extension. I've been writing them forever, but they used to be sitting on the website. And someone recently said, you should publish them. And that's when I started just writing. I think I go with what I'm feeling, the market. I'm forecasting what I see. I'm expressing myself in terms of what I hope to see. You know, I'm sharing my views, but I'm always trying to be positive and bring to life the challenges at the same time in a positive light. And to acknowledge that we are in a country where the grit and the resilience of the people around us is extraordinary. And that's one of the reasons of the success of our company, too. So when I write, it's really from the heart, from experiences to share knowledge and at the same time to be part of the bigger stories that are going around, you know, to add on and also to learn from other people.
Do you have like a PR person who helps you with this distribution and so on? Is this something you advise other businesses, business owners, restaurant business owners in your case to do?
I think blogs are a great way to express your brand. Not everybody can write. Not everybody needs to write. If it's not something they do, then they should outsource that. But I think it's brand communication. As a consultant, my brand communication is communicating who we are and how we work and what value we bring to your business and where our experience is at the stage. So I definitely think that we need to be communicating. Brands need to be expressing themselves, not always by writing. Writing is not something people read all the time. Sometimes it's just visual. Videos make a lot of difference. So we also do a lot of videos. We tell our stories in videos. We tell our stories in graphics. I think if we're not communicating, we're not alive. We need to be alive, kicking, communicating every single day.
The last question I have for you before the rapid fire questions is, what's your advice for people who want to open up a restaurant? So I get a lot of people who ask me, I want to do an app, I want to do tech and so on. And then I tell them, look, the minimum you need to spend on this is around $80,000, $40,000 to build something, and another $40,000 in communication, like advertising and so on. From that, you'll be able to get a gist of, is this going to go anywhere? Most people I see, they spend $200,000 on building and employees and rent and things like this, and they leave $10,000 to spend on marketing, and then they don't have an answer. My recommendation is always, it's at least 80, half building, half communicating. What's your restaurant equivalent of that?
Are you talking about what is my advice to people opening a restaurant, how to allocate their funds, or what's the most important?
It's more of, let's do this, because the scenario I have always, it's in a social setting where, oh, Ayman, you understand this internet thing. I have a friend here, she's always wanted to open up an app, or he's always wanted to do this. The same in your case, oh, I've always wanted to have my grandmother's recipe. I always wanted this, open up this popcorn concept and whatever and so on. My advice to them is very quickly saying, look, this is the amount of money. This is, you need $80,000 over 6 months. Mm-hmm. Don't ponder for years. And if it's less than that, there's little you can do. If it's more than that, of course, you can do more. But if it's less than that, less than 80,000, less than 6 months, you can't find an answer. And that's where most people stop. So what's your equivalent of that?
I think it's similar to what you're saying. We've learned over the years that the escalation of numbers with all the years that are passing by, things are changing, but there's a certain amount of amounts that we need, which is licensing fees, labor costs, you know, build costs. And that's the stuff that I highlighted in my articles, that you can have something in $500,000 that could be equivalent to a dark kitchen, because the math just shows very clearly that you will need equipment, you'll need a product, you'll need an aggregator and a bit of marketing and staff, you know. So that's simple math. No matter how you stretch it, that's a good amount. The one advice I give to people is, no matter what that capex is, if it's $1.5 million, it's $3 million, $5 million, $20 million, based on what is the end in mind, always have a contingency fund. Always be prepared for 6 months to be able to support your business with amounts kept aside for your rents and for your suppliers and for your staff.
$150,000 to $200,000 then. So 80 to 100 to build it, and then another to build and promote it, and then another 80 to 100 to sustain it just in case it doesn't go well.
So contingencies will be equivalent of what your salaries are and what your rent is to be put aside. So we work it out on a pre-opening cost. We assign a pre-opening, then we assign a post-opening 6 months contingency based on the people that have to get paid no matter what happens.
And so on.
We ask for reserves to be put aside, and it's always been a smart move, and people do that because otherwise they start getting into the loans and the desperation, and then they start marketing, and they just go all over the place, and it's never easy to rescue something that's bleeding, because when you're bleeding, you've lost hope, you've lost money, there's not much you can do. So I'd rather have them keep that, and I sometimes tell people to go back and come back when they've got the right funds, or bring investors on board and do it right, or do not do it. I've sent a lot of people back home saying, do not do it. Invest in real estate. It's a small amount of returns, but at least you're safe, you know? It's not going anywhere. But don't get into a business where you're going to run out of cash halfway through. It's brutal. You cannot recover from it.
And most of this is personal money, right? It's not institutional investors, natural capitals, and so on, right? So it's usually personal money to go in.
It differs. We're not in the part of the world where it's easy to get angel investors on board so fast. There's a whole process. This part of the world has very different, at this point, structure on fundings, on loans. Most of these people bring in their own funds. Sometimes it's a partnership of 3-4 people come together. Sometimes they do take on SMEs, loans from small business financing. And then there are those. I also work with very large corporations that are billion-dollar conglomerates, and they want to venture into the F&B business. We've recently done something for the apparel group that has 40-plus franchises that they've brought in from around the world into the country, and we've built their first homegrown brand here. So that's a whole different kind of a funding when those people do stuff like that. So we have all kinds of clients.
All right, rapid-fire questions. Professionally, was COVID a blessing or a curse?
For me personally, a lot of my world was changed personally, which without going into details, has turned out to be one of the best things of my life. I look back at a lot of my things in my life that have happened, and I believe I'm a woman of faith. I believe that things come my way because they come to teach me. They're not failures. They're opportunities to learn. And COVID has been very difficult for a lot of us. And the ones who have looked at it from the point of view that this too shall pass and we shall move forward have moved forward.
Excellent. What do your friends or family or grandparents think you do as a restaurant consultant?
They think I talk to a lot of people, and I enjoy meeting people, and I tell people what to do. I'm a bit of a boss lady, I think, and I think it trickles down a little bit at home, me advising and consulting everyone. And I think they hate it when I tell them how to cook because I'm not the best cook. That's a secret I'm telling you, Eamon, online, officially.
What is one thing that you love about being in the restaurant consulting business, and what is one thing that you hate about being in the restaurant consulting business?
I love the creativity that I am able to tap into to myself and through people around. I love the people aspect of it. I love the glamour of it. I love the romance of F&B, of seeing a smile on a client's face when they open doors. I've seen clients have tears when they've seen queues outside. I love that rewarding feeling of having brought someone's dream to life. What I don't like about the business today is when I see young people in restaurants come up too fast sometimes, grow too fast, and then fail because they've just been pushed, long hours. I think it's a very brutal business, and we really, our industry really needs to have a bit more of standardization of working hours and, you know, salaries and stuff like that. I would love to see people able to enjoy these people. We serve customers. We cook all the time. We work on Christmas. We work New Year's. We work public holidays. And we and our families don't get to enjoy that. I myself have spent so many Christmases on airports, calling, taking up calls, helping clients. So I think that's part of the business that's the, you know, part of the game. Yeah.
When you finish college, what do you think you're going to do?
I wanted to be an air hostess. I wanted to travel the world.
Really? Okay. But how did you shift into this then? What led you there?
This is the grace of God. I'm so glad I'm not an air hostess. My father used to always tell me, you know, you're meant for something else. And that was the only thing that I wanted. I used to think I'm not getting what I want. But I believe that there is a plan for our lives. There's a call on our lives. And if we allow ourselves to, you know, just see what's coming and give in to those things, it happens. And I found myself using my creativity, my joy of travel, my vision to serve people find itself in this field.
What's the most unusual food idea you've ever encountered or tasted?
On the receiving end or trying it for a client?
As a customer, you know, they came in, they said, I want to open up a, I don't know, Oreo Cheez-Its flavored whatever.
You'll be surprised. It's so trendy right now. But a few years back, we were approached by two Emirati young men. They were 23 years old at that point, and they wanted to infuse the sushi with Emirati cuisine. And we're talking about very early years, 2015 or so, when it was not so rampant as it is right now, the way we're seeing fusions. And to work with them and have that idea of theirs come to life and them actually winning awards for the menu that we developed together was one of the challenges that for me personally was I could not register the way sushi and Emirati cooked food could come together. But people loved it, and that's what matters. I think they were very bold to have that idea, and we sort of worked together as a team to bring it alive.
A lot of people I know, the last question is, a lot of people I know in the services business, when they have late nights and, you know, they say, look, I want to just shut down the business, open up like a physical store that's cash-based. I don't want to chase clients for money or it's cash-based. I just feel, you know, I want to, you know, close my store and then leave. Do you have your own food equivalent of this where you want to, I don't know, food vlog your way through Asia?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that, Eamon. I'm very sorry.
Do you have whims of when you have those late nights in the service industry, like you mentioned, like, you know, weekends and holidays and so on? It's a very services-based business that you're in. So you're in services business that's servicing a service business. So it's very services-driven, which has its own operational intensity. That tends to lead to a lot of pressure and so on. So when I've seen people in this situation, they sometimes wish they don't do this, but they sometimes wish that they close down a services business and they open up a store, like a store that they sell a few things. And then when they've done a three or four, they close out the store and they leave. It's just, you know, the same way where you have a small store in Europe where it's owned by somebody who opens it anytime they want, close it anytime they want. Do you have any such wishes, but they're on the food side where you vlog your way through Asia, like I see on YouTube, you become a food vlogger for a year?
I get you now. Actually, that's I'm on the opposite end of that. I'm actually launching a company that I will publish in a month or so, where I'm going deeper into the F&B consultancy. I'm going to the next level with F&B. This is my passion. This is what I do. So I'm going deeper into it. I'm not a very digital person. I'm not a, you know, my generation understands people, the connections and stuff. So my dream is still to have an extraordinary restaurant, another one. It's a dream restaurant I have in mind. So yes, maybe one day I will open a restaurant that will floor the world with its cuisine and its wine list. The consultancy will see its next level, where we'll go into dark kitchens, we'll go into operational management of companies. Yeah, that's not, nothing's going to stop me now for a while. So help me God, that's the way I'm going. No vlogs for me yet.
Gabriel, I want to thank you for your time with us today, answering the psychology of restaurant owners and their problems and their solutions and what they can or can't do. Thank you for that. Where do people, can they read your content or reach you?
So we are on restaurantsecrets.com. That's our website. We are also very, very active on social media, on Instagram. I don't have the handle, but if I think anybody goes onto our website, we're also available on Dubai Landline 33100 33.
Thank you, Gabriel, for being with us today.